Welcome to the Medical Journal of Australia podcast. The MJA is Australia's top peer-reviewed general medical journal, publishing groundbreaking research to the medical community since 1914. My name is Kate Swanell, and I am the MJA's news and online editor. Simon Lewis is Professor of Cognitive Neuroscience at the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre. He has written a perspective on Parkinson's disease, which was published online by the MJA on the 9th of April 2018. It is available and open access until the 16th of April at www.mja.com.au. Professor Lewis is my special guest on the pod today. Is there anything more complicated than Parkinson's disease?
No.
No, I don't think so either. We don't have a cause. Are we closer to having a clue about the cause?
Yeah, so I guess our challenge in Parkinson's disease is we're looking for a cure for a disease that we actually don't understand. Mm. We don't know the cause of Parkinson's disease. We have got some clues, and I think that it's a bit like one of those situations where the more you find out, the less you know. So I guess we do get some clues as to, you know, what might be causing Parkinson's disease if you look at saying, well, when we look in medicine, is there a genetic cause? And there are a few gene-causing Parkinson's situations. So, you know, people have done research and found various genes that may account for a small percentage of the number of patients we have. Now, some of those stand out pretty obviously, where you've got a younger onset, someone under the age of 30, and they tell you, look, I've got three cousins and two brothers and a grandfather who all had this, and you say, okay, well, that's going to be genetic. But there are also some genes out there which really don't have that pattern and look like bog-standard run-of-the-mill Parkinson's, and in actual fact, probably the commonest genetic abnormality links into something that medics will have heard of, which is called Gaucher's or Gaucher's disease, which people will recognize as being a lysosomal storage disease where you lose both copies of an enzyme, glucocerebrosidase, which clears junk, if you like, from lysosomes. And what's interesting in the last few years is that we've recognized that about 5% of patients with Parkinson's disease are heterozygotes. That particular gene. So it's fair to say there are lots of people out there who might have the gene and don't have Parkinson's, or maybe don't have Parkinson's yet. But the truth is these seem to be these at-risk genes as well, which are playing into the mix. And of course, when we talk about genes and finding the cure for Parkinson's, what we really want to know is what are the genes doing? And, you know, perfect example, if they're related in clearing junk out of lysosomes, well, maybe they're involved in that sort of system. Their breakdown then leads to the buildup of aggregated proteins, which then leads to cell death. And you say, oh, well, that might link to Parkinson's disease and form the strategy for a treatment. I mean, the other thing I think we've seen in terms of clues, as it were, is that, you know, there is epidemiology out there, and it's never all that strong. It makes for great headlines when you say to somebody, oh, you know, if you're a smoker, you halve the risk of getting Parkinson's disease. That's a great headline. But
yes,
of course, what you mean is you're going from a 1 in 1,000 risk to a 1 in 2,000 risk, which, you know, isn't great. But it does give you a clue. And, you know, this then triggers things like saying, well, maybe there's something in cigarettes. And in actual fact, very recently, we're seeing trials that are registered using things like nicotine patches to see whether you might be able to slow Parkinson's disease. And so looking at things that, you know, we know about, and I guess the other hot area at the moment would be the study that arose out of the beta adrenoceptors story, which basically is very interesting insofar as there's a sort of large cohort, epidemiological cohort that they looked at, and they said, gosh, if people were on a puffer, like a salbutamol puffer, a beta agonist, they seem to have less chance of getting Parkinson's. Yet if they're on a beta blocker, you know, a blood pressure type treatment, they seem to be at increased risk of getting Parkinson's. And then you say, well, okay, how might that actually be operating? And, you know, some clever work looking at, if you like, the regulation of genes that were involved or have been identified in the role in Parkinson's, such as synuclein protein. It does appear that these, you know, drugs might be able to influence the expression of those genes. And then you sort of go, okay, well, that might be another insight. And certainly, you know, this is the area, I suppose, where we're all looking to say, well, what other things have people noticed? Or in animal work, what else can we see? Whether it's, you know, hey, there seems to be a buildup of inflammation here, and that may be secondary to cell death. It might be leading cell death. Hey, there looks like there's a problem with the energy supply to the cell, the mitochondrial enzyme chains, balancing, if you like, the ions across the cell membrane, the calcium homeostasis that people, you know, research. And so there are lots of these things that come out of, if you like, the basic science, where people are making observations from models, animal models, or observations from patient studies. And so I think those give us our clue. And I think what that means, that for the first time, certainly probably in the last decade, it feels like for me, we're actually seeing, if you like, hope, perhaps a little bit of hype, but some hope going forwards regarding whether we might actually be able to treat Parkinson's. And I guess that comes back to whether, you know, I mean, cure is a four-letter word. Here we're talking about a disease which presents generally after you've lost maybe half of the important cells, as it were, or the dopamine-producing cells. So at the time when a patient actually presents, they may have lost half of those cells. Now, with the best will in the world, I mean, people talk about cell replacement therapy. That may be a strategy to hold the process. But with the best will in the world, I don't think any of our treatment, our cures, are going to do more than saying, okay, look, if we can stop more cell death, that may be as good as... And to be honest, if I offered that deal to a patient right now, they'd take it. Because, of course, the problem here is that, you know, with that relentless cell death, we see people getting worse physically and, of course, on the non-motor side, the things that put you into a nursing home, like dementia and hallucinations. So lots of those things. I mean, there are other strategies that people are looking at, and, you know, the idea of saying, well, can we recognize the disease before it even starts? And you'll know from my own work and others, people are looking at the risk factors for developing Parkinson's, and I guess people are familiar with the idea of losing your sense of smell. Well, that might give you an odds ratio of something like 3, maybe 4 times the baseline. But the dream enactment behavior of idiopathic REM sleep behavior disorder, that's 130, 140 times the risk. Finding those patients and targeting disease modification in those patients who haven't necessarily lost that many of their dopamine cells is an international effort, you know, that's going on at the moment, where people are gathering patient records and saying, look, when the day comes that we have the possibility to do a trial, are we ready? And the answer is hopefully yes.
Is it possible, given all these different theories and all these different clues, is it possible that Parkinson's is not so much a specific disease as a set of diseases in a syndrome?
Yeah, look, this is, I mean, this is one of the big things, and, you know, we cover it in the article, which is, you know, it may be that in everybody we've got different processes that are going on, or it may, and it may well be that, you know, let's say you target one of those processes, like removing an abnormal protein and clearing the junk out of the cell, but actually you don't know if that junk was actually trying to protect the cell.
Yeah.
So actually you may tilt the balance in favor of the other processes that it was trying to compensate for. So there's this idea that, you know, you might have lots of processes going on, and in some ways it might be that what we need to do is create a dirty bomb or a dirty drug that actually covers all of these bases, rather than the approach of saying, well, we'll pick this one thing or pick that one thing.
Yeah.
And I guess the idea really is saying, okay, well, assuming that everyone's the same, we might have multiple processes, but of course, what if not everybody's the same? What if in some people the genetic thing is driving it more in them, and they have a different set of pathways than in the other people who might not have a genetic predisposition, and their pathways from some other, say, environmental toxin? So
yeah.
I think that, you know, we do have that challenge, and I guess this comes back to whether your term is precision or personalized medicine, but, you know, I think we're at a level where we'd really like just some insight into how we might tackle the disease, and then, you know, precision it up a little bit later on.
Is there a danger of becoming paralyzed by all those choices?
Look, I think the fact is that the way that medicine tends to work is that we tend to like to do one thing at a time. And so, you know, I think the feeling would be, look, if we thought that the inflammation was the target, we would work on a drug that would target inflammation. Now, I think there are opportunities to measure more than that. So, for example, if you were to say, look, I've got a way of measuring how much of this abnormal protein is made in the brain, but you think your drug works on inflammation, why don't we measure both? Because in actual fact, if it doesn't get a target engagement on inflammation, but it does show a difference on the protein, then actually it may be working by a completely different mechanism.
Yeah,
so I don't
right.
think people get paralyzed. I think people will pick one thing and then we'll see. The problem is the idea of saying, well, I think we need to do both at the same time. Here, let's do a drug trial where we have an agent that we think does both. And you know, people have given thought to these things, and they haven't generally been successful to this point, although, you know, we are starting to see some small successes.
Your paper this time around is specifically about repurposing drugs for use in Parkinson's treatment. Tell us about, for example, the repurposing of some diabetes drugs. How is that going, and what's that showing?
I think we're at a point where we're seeing, if you like, two strands of how we tackle Parkinson's disease in a sort of pharmacological way. One, how do we come up with a new agent? You know, let's say, for example, the idea of breaking up proteins. Mm-hmm. You know, people are looking at the idea of, if you like, modulating the immune system, either through a passive immunity or an active immunity. So a bit like giving someone a vaccine and saying you're never going to get Parkinson's, or saying you've got this antibody, or sorry, we've got this antibody that will break up that protein. And those sort of novel molecule approaches are very expensive.
You know,
they're the sort of thing that, you know, they're high risk and they're pretty slow, and they're going to, you know, probably take a long time to come to market, and we're going to see a few failures along the way, and hopefully we won't see any disasters along the way.
Yeah.
In terms of the other approach, which is to say, well, you know, we've got some things that we know are safe in humans, and we've got some rationale as to why they might work. And this comes back to that concept of, do we have, you know, drugs that might act to stabilize calcium homeostasis, and therefore let's put them into a trial. And so, you know, something like the exenatide trial that was published last year, small phase two, but, you know, encouraging results, mm-hmm. you know, takes a drug which essentially is a glucagon-like peptide 1 agonist. Yeah. And you go, okay, well, why should a drug that helps diabetes help with Parkinson's? Well, the answer is that it seems that these agents have, you know, impacts on autophagy and antioxidant pathways and pro-inflammatory pathways and neuroplasticity, and it may be doing none of those things. It may be doing all of those things.
Yeah.
But essentially, you know, the idea of taking something that's safe in a human and can, if you like, be readily translated. And, you know, I think the trick to this, and one of the approaches that, you know, I think I'm involved with myself, is the idea of, well, can we try and screen these drugs, see if there's a signal, and then take it to the, if you like, the phase three randomized control trial level and multi-center it up. So I think we are, you know, at a point where we're seeing these opportunities arise. And on top of that, we are seeing not only the novel molecules coming out of industry, but also, you know, repurposing going on in terms of, you know, taking drugs that are available for the different indication and putting them into practice. So, for example, you know, the paper talks about deferiprone, an iron chelating agent used for thalassemia for, you know, a couple of decades now.
Yeah. But
the observation from postmortem that the part of the brain that's dying in Parkinson's, the substantia nigra, has an excess iron accumulation, leads to the concept, well, maybe if we could take iron out of the brain using something that is a chelator of iron, that might be an approach. So even in industry, we're seeing the possibility of repurposing drugs. So I think these have some fast-track advantages.
Are the pharmaceuticals taking an interest in Parkinson's?
Look, I think there's certainly more interest now than there was a decade ago. I don't know if it's a perfect storm of not having enough know-how or insight, plus the global financial crisis that, you know, ripped a lot of funding away from industry. But I do see that there is now a passion, and, you know, certainly industry partners are coming along and saying, look, we'd like to recruit patients here in Australia. And, you know, we haven't seen that.
Yeah,
for a very long time. And I think it's encouraging. We've got large populations of patients who are very keen to, and willing to get involved in these, you know, well-constructed studies. We've got a very skilled workforce of experts that have been underused in this space. And
yeah.
So, you know, I'm hoping that we're going to see some bright times on the horizon.
What's your gut feeling, Simon? Do you think there's going to be a silver bullet somewhere where somebody goes, oh, my God, that's what causes it? Or do you think we're just going to be able to have a variety of treatments for the variety of Parkinson's that seems to be out there?
Yeah, look, I think my gut feeling is very much that sort of incremental approach. I mean, I think that, you know, the idea that we'd suddenly get a major hit and it would cure the disease in everybody, you know, is something that is an aspiration. But, you know, I've had a number of colleagues, I guess, who, you know, if we think about, who may still be working or have retired, and they will have seen Parkinson's disease before levodopa, you know, in the 1960s, then seen the levodopa, and then seen deep brain stimulation, and then, you know, maybe they've retired, maybe they've expired, but they haven't seen a cure. And I think, you know, for me, I'm very grateful that I'm in a space where we can talk about, you know, trying to do something positive, because Lord knows our patients really want to get involved, and I think we'd like to be able to offer them something. And of course, you know, if we can do this in Parkinson's, you know, other conditions, especially things like Lewy body dementia, which essentially is like having Parkinson's on speed, you go, well, if it works in Parkinson's, geez, it should really work in Lewy body dementia. And of course, it might open up avenues for other degenerative diseases where you say, well, currently, you know, something like the Parkinson mimics the progressive supranuclear palsy, the multiple system atrophy. They're a little bit orphan diseases at the moment because they're not huge targets for industry. And, and you know, if you got a little breakthrough somewhere, you might go, well, okay, great. Can we do something in this space as well? So, you know, I think that's where we hope to be looking. We kind of, you know, when we're taking our histories, we get told all the time, well, we think granddad might have had it, but it was at a time when we really didn't have any doctors and we didn't see them. So I think that's, you know, that's a common tale.
What is a, is it a prion-like disease?
So I think a lot of the approach with targeting the aggregated proteins inside the dying brain cells in Parkinson's, or what we call the Lewy bodies, or these tangles of alpha-synuclein protein, are really kind of coming off the back of some work that came out probably over the last decade or so, that has led to the idea that Parkinson's might be a prion-like protein disease. Now, people are familiar with the idea of prion. They've heard of Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease and variant Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease with this sort of bovine sponge-forming encephalopathy mad cow story. And the idea goes, well, if there's some kind of trigger that can change one of your native proteins into something that won't be broken down, won't be degraded, then that's the sort of, if you like, the essence of prion. And the idea that it can spread relentlessly from cell to cell. In fact, of course, we have to, you know, throw away operating equipment. We can't use it again. It's that resistant to our cleaving processes, autoclave and things like that. So, in terms of where the story arises, it really comes out of an effort to be treating Parkinson's through cell transplantation. So the word stem cells get bandied around, but here what we're really talking about was the idea of taking fetal grafts, so cells from a number of aborted fetuses that were destined to become dopamine-producing neurons, and implanting those into patients with advanced Parkinson's. And these studies were done, there were a couple of them in the States in the early noughties, where they actually were stopped for safety reasons because patients developed what we call runaway dyskinesias. They had involuntary movements that actually required deep brain stimulation surgery to try and contain their symptoms. And you sort of think, well, that sounds as though some of the Parkinson's might have been better in the sense that dopamine was in the system, but obviously not a very safe treatment. So the outcome, though, was that the patients were continued to be followed. In actual fact, when they started to come post-mortem, they decided they wanted to examine the cells that they'd put into the brain, which had come from the fetuses, which clearly could not have had Parkinson's disease. And what they found was inside those cells that had been put into the brain were some tangles, these Lewy body formations of alpha-synuclein. The argument goes, well, maybe this alpha-synuclein has actually been, if you like, transfected from the host into the graft.
Right.
And this is what we see in prion disease. And there are sort of now a number of animal models using, if you like, synuclein as the transfecting agent, which can move from cell to cell. And people are also developing things like rabies virus carried approaches to put this into the system. And one of the reasons this gathers more weight is because, again, from, if you like, our epidemiology, we know that before people get physical Parkinson's symptoms, they often get things like constipation and losing their sense of smell. Or the idea would be that if you inhale or you ingest a trigger for the prion process, if you like, then it might get into your gut or into your nose, and that might impact upon the function of those structures. And this is further enhanced by the fact that the pathology that you see first in the brain of Parkinson's seems to be around the area where the vagus nerve, which, as you know, goes off to the enteric system, and heart, so that, you know, the idea that something might, if you like, creep along these peripheral nerves and then get to the brain and then spread through the brain relentlessly. Now, there are some caveats, and one of the most obvious caveats is that when you look at Parkinson's disease under the microscope, you don't tend to get these Lewy bodies in the area where they put the fetal graft. So it's kind of odd that this situation would have arisen, and there are obviously any number of reasons why that might be. You know, you penetrated through into an area of the brain that doesn't normally have tissues added to it. So it's a little bit tricky, but and when people have looked at the idea of trying to transfect from human tissue, and some of this actually came from Sydney, from the brain bank here, taking cells from post-mortem Parkinson's patients, then trying to transfect, if you like, Parkinson's into animal mouse models, it didn't work for Parkinson's. Interestingly, it did work for multiple system atrophy patients, a mimic of Parkinson's disease. But if you look at the model, as I say, the group that did that, and that was actually Stan Prusiner's group, who got the Nobel Prize for his work in prion, wasn't able to transfect in a prion-like fashion the Parkinson's disease that was taken from postmortem samples into these mice, although, as I say, it did work for multiple system atrophy. But this really then sort of leads to the idea that this prion is something that might move from cell to cell, and then if we were going to try and treat it, perhaps what we could do is to either try and, if you like, untangle the protein, block the protein, but more likely try and just stop the trafficking from cell to cell. And people are looking at things like monoclonal antibodies that might be able to block or switch off that trafficking mechanism. So that's probably one of the exciting areas. There are patients who are enrolled in trials in America at the moment who would be part of the safety data for that sort of approach.
It sounds to me like if I'm an early career researcher, Parkinson's is where I should be heading.
Look, it's an exciting area. I mean, it shouldn't be. I mean, I guess the one thing we would say about this idea of changing the protein is we don't want to get too excited. We've seen Alzheimer's as a model with proteins where we can take amyloid out of the brain of mice and they start to swim around a water maze. But, of course, when we do the same in the patients with early Alzheimer's or mild cognitive impairment, we're just not seeing those sorts of improvements. So, you know, I think it's fair to say that I have very few mice that are waiting to see me. They might be in my waiting room, but they generally don't have the disease. They might just be waiting for crumbs off the table.
Thanks, Simon.
Marvellous. Thanks, Kate.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.